This is Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight on Your Legal Rights, we discuss the PG&E bankruptcy. My guest tonight is Leon Bayer of Los Angeles, certified as a bankruptcy law specialist by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar of California. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number to us right here in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're calling from outside of San Francisco, please call us on our toll-free number, 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on the topic, and that topic tonight is bankruptcy. If you have a question about bankruptcy or debtor's rights, you're not limited to the point we are in the conversation here. You can join us with any of your questions. And again, if you're calling from outside of the local area, our number is 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. And Leon Bayer, let me welcome you to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be back, and thanks for having me again.
And I promise I won't break any bones while we're talking tonight. But I'd like to start here. You know, so PG&E has filed bankruptcy. How does such a corporate bankruptcy differ from an individual bankruptcy? I mean, how is it different from what they do versus what you and I might do?
Let me first give you just a quick beginner's summary of what personal bankruptcy generally involves. It involves the filing of a bankruptcy case with the clerk of the United States Bankruptcy Court. The filing of the case creates an immediate automatic restraining order in favor of the debtor. The debtor is the person who files bankruptcy, and that restraining order protects the debtor from creditors. It orders creditors to stop calling and demanding money. Creditors that might perhaps already be suing the debtor or getting ready to sue have to stop in their tracks. If you file bankruptcy while someone is garnishing your wages, they have to stop immediately. So it's a very strong, powerful remedy. And in the typical consumer bankruptcy case, probably a Chapter 7 bankruptcy case, which is the most popular type that gets filed more often than all the other bankruptcy versions. At the end of the Chapter 7, the debtor gains a discharge, which means most of their debts are wiped out. They don't ever have to pay them again. Now let's contrast that with Chapter 11. Chapter 11 is a very complex bankruptcy proceeding. In addition to PG&E filing this past week its bankruptcy case, we have other recent bankruptcy filings by Sears. Who hasn't bought something from Sears and maybe bought an extended warranty on the washing machine or something? Every consumer that has dealt with Sears on that basis is a potential creditor in the case and needs to know what's going on. Likewise, Pacific Gas and Electric, filing Chapter 11, they provide utility services to 16 million people. This is big. You know, a typical Chapter 11 maybe gets filed by somebody who owns an apartment building that's in foreclosure or something. It doesn't affect people on the scale that a public utility is going to involve people in. So everybody who's got claims from the wildfires and you name it, maybe just, you know, a utility pole fell down and crushed their parked car or all kinds of things. Everybody who has any such involvement with PG&E is a creditor in that case and certainly needs to have some personal concern about what's going on there. Chapter 11 is a reorganization. So unlike the Chapter 7 that your host or myself might file if need be, Chapter 11 can provide a basis for the assets of the bankrupt company to be liquidated in an orderly fashion, sold at market value. Or it may provide for a reorganization plan where the company's debts are going to be restructured. Probably most Chapter 11 cases start out with the idea of seeking a restructuring of debt. And creditors have certain rights to object if the proposed plan is going to change any of their legal rights that they used to hold. There are other considerations. You know, a Chapter 11 plan, how much do they really have to pay their creditors? You know, they probably want to pay the creditors nothing. But the law commands that you must look at the value of the assets. There is something called the best interest of creditors test for the confirmation of a plan, in which the plan cannot be confirmed or approved by the court if the plan is not going to treat creditors to pay them as much as a creditor would have received in just a straight liquidation of assets and pro rata distribution to creditors. So there's just a whole lot going on always in a Chapter 11. They're complex. And then when you consider the fact you got a publicly traded company here, which provides utility service to 16 million people, it's going to be a mess. It's going to be a big mess.
Any likelihood that 16 million people, that's half of California, could get thrown into a dark age? Are they really going away?
Have you been out driving around looking for a cave to live in?
Probably not.
So there's no danger that everybody's power is going to suddenly be turned off. That's not going to happen. The real question is going to be, what's going to happen to all the shareholders? You know, there's so many pension plans and probably even retirees that have stock in PG&E. What's going to happen to that? Because think about that. They are, in effect, the owners of that utility. And in these big Chapter 11 cases, what typically happens is the shareholders typically wind up wiped out, losing everything. It's basically what happened in the General Motors bankruptcy case. Various classes of creditors who held bonds issued by General Motors, or they had shares of preferred stock, debentures, bonds, debts that were owed by General Motors, they got something. But the people who got nothing were the shareholders.
I remember the owner of a local sports franchise commenting when the fans were rather upset with performance, saying, you know, well, I'm an owner. You can't trade owners. But isn't that, in essence, what they're doing? Is they're basically jettisoning the owners and in order that the entity can keep going?
Well, that's right. But then somebody's got to own it. Well, it usually is not going to be the former shareholders. Usually in these giant restructuring Chapter 11 cases, new classes of shareholders will be created. For example, in General Motors, the unions wound up with large blocks of stock. And that was probably what's going to happen with PG&E. I wouldn't be surprised if everybody that has a wildfire claim against them, either for property damage, personal injury, wrongful death, I wouldn't be surprised to see new classes of stock created and distributed to those claim holders. But that's just speculation on my part. I mean, it's just way too early to see what direction is going to be taken.
So the idea is to jettison their liability, but they're basically giving up capital so that later on these people can be made whole by selling stock or whatever it may be when the company's back on its feet.
That's usually the express goal. Sometimes liquidation of assets can yield enough cash proceeds to pay off impaired classes of creditors. And there's going to be a huge fight over the company's liability from all these fires. You know, to what extent did the company equipment or failure to maintain equipment lead or contribute to these catastrophes. There's going to be a lot of litigation on this, whether it's in Chapter 11 or not.
Aren't these fights often one group of creditors versus another?
Yes, that's right, because different classes of creditors don't have the same interest. So, for example, the fire victims, fire claimants, really could care less whether energy wholesalers or energy middlemen that were selling power to PG&E, whether they get screwed over. You know, it's dog eat dog, every man for himself. So there are different groups of creditors that will be trying to undermine each other. And it's anybody's guess how it's going to wind up. My own feeling is probably there will be some kind of a special master appointed to determine a fair and equitable distribution to creditors that have the fire claims. There are, you know, potentially, you know, thousands of these cases that are going to require adjudication. Just because someone says my property was damaged or a loved one was badly hurt or died in the fire doesn't automatically make it the fault of the utility. It's got to be adjudicated somehow through the legal system. That could be done in the bankruptcy court. It could be done in California state courts.
You also mentioned wildfire victims, and one thing that might take, maybe is worth talking about a little bit, is the difference between the wildfire victims as they exist today, but knowing that there's power lines out there, there's wind out there, there's fires that are going to come up periodically in the future. And to some extent, isn't there going to be a line drawn between those people who were victims before this bankruptcy has run its course and is discharged? Don't future victims start out with pretty much a clean slate, not affected by the bankruptcy?
Yes, that's an excellent point. And they may have a superior type of a claim that moves them to the front of the line. You know, and since we're talking off the cuff about this stuff, you know, the victims or the claimants of each one of the particular fires is perhaps going to wind up in a separate class. And it doesn't mean that each different wildfire class is going to get paid the same as all the others. I believe the state of California has determined that something like 17 different wildfires were the fault of PG&E, but that's a regulatory finding or an investigative finding. It's not a finding that's been adjudicated in a court of law, and those findings may stand or be overturned. It's going to be just a really big mess. But the consumers are not going to have their power turned off, and the other certainty is shareholders are probably going to be wiped out. And that's why the price of stock in PG&E just fell so drastically in the weeks leading up to the bankruptcy. PG&E had announced that it would file a bankruptcy, or that it was considering the filing of a bankruptcy, and that put all shareholders and investors on notice. And that's why, you know, when these things happen, the price of a share of stock that maybe used to sell a couple years ago for $70 or $80 might now be selling for 70 or 80 cents.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden, and tonight we're talking about the PG&E bankruptcy. My guest tonight is Leon Bayer, Certified Bankruptcy Law Specialist from the California Board of Legal Specialization, State Bar of California. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, please call us toll-free. That number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. 798-8255. 8255. And as always, you can call regarding any question on the topic of the night. Tonight, that topic is bankruptcy. You're not limited to where we may be in our conversation. If you have a question about bankruptcy or debtor's rights, please call us without regard to what we're talking about. We're more than happy to take your call. That's why we're here. So, you mentioned about liquidation and reorganization. Can you give an example of something that people might be familiar with in a liquidation mode as opposed to one that's in a reorganization mode?
Sure. Let's say a small family-owned hardware store that's been in business for 60 years has to close its doors. Too much competition from the big box stores, not enough foot traffic, all kinds of problems will affect a small business. They might file Chapter 11 to have a orderly liquidation of assets. They might just enter into Chapter 7, which doesn't involve any reorganization plan. A Chapter 7 in a case like that involves a court-appointed trustee appointed through the Justice Department system, who then takes control of the assets and has bankruptcy sales. So they'll put up banners at the store and, you know, everything is 50% off and cash and carry, that kind of thing. So that represents a liquidation. And when a consumer like Jeff or myself or you listeners file personal bankruptcy under Chapter 7, we are filing a liquidation case. In theory, our assets are going to be liquidated and the proceeds used largely for payment of creditor claims. However, in the normal consumer bankruptcy case, there is nothing to liquidate. It's not that you walk into court wearing a barrel over yourself because all your clothes and everything have been taken away. That's because the law is extremely generous about the stuff you get to keep when you file bankruptcy. Most individuals who file a bankruptcy case do not surrender any asset to the court. The law is very, very generous about letting you keep things. A person who owns a home in California, a single person without dependents, would be able to keep $75,000 of equity in their home. If you are 65 years of age or older, or disabled, you get to protect $175,000 of equity. You also get to keep the money in your retirement accounts. You're also allowed to shelter certain amounts of cash, maybe as much as $28,000 of cash or other assets if you don't own a home. So there's all kinds of choices to be made when you file a personal bankruptcy case about what you're going to claim as your exempt property. And if you have assets, if your total assets are added up in value to be greater than the amount of exemptions you're entitled to, then you and your attorney need to make strategic decisions on which assets you really want to exempt. You may have some assets of really marginal value. Let's say you've got a, Jeff, don't you still have a 1981 Yugo in your garage?
I agree that's of marginal value, and it's missing some of the parts. The tires are next door with the neighbor who I owed a little money to, but that's a
funny
different story.
How assets like that are always in parts. So, yeah, Jeff might use a claim of exemption on that, but you know what? If he goes naked on that asset and uses his exemption dollars for something else, it's a certainty the bankruptcy trustee is not going to touch that old car because it's not worth anything. There's always costs of sale and storage involved when a trustee takes over the assets of a bankruptcy estate. And there's no money to be made in trying to administer old, outdated, useless things like a 1981 Yugoslavian Yugo automobile.
So my brand new Tesla might be more interested, of greater interest to them than my, you know, than my Yugo, which was $39.90 brand new, and even then you'd probably be better off with a used car. We did get a question from a listener on another. I see a call is working its way through. But a listener did ask, if you've homesteaded your home, how does a bankruptcy affect the homestead?
Sure. The homestead is another one of these exemption laws. The exemptions being the categories of assets that you get to keep when you file a bankruptcy, or they are also categories of assets that are exempt from being taken away from you involuntarily if someone has sued you and obtained a court judgment against you. Those same exemptions, or most of the same exemptions, will come into play. I'm sorry, I kind of lost what the thrust of the question was.
Well, the question was how the bankruptcy affects the homestead.
Oh, the homestead, sure. Well, homestead, if you own a home and you live there, you have an automatic homestead. You don't have to file or record anything in the county recorder's office. There's nothing special that you need to do. You already have a homestead. You don't have to fill out paperwork for it. And the homestead exemption statute, as it exists in the laws of the state of California, apply in a federal bankruptcy case. So most people who own a home and file bankruptcy are never going to face the loss of their home in the bankruptcy, at least not to the bankruptcy court. Now, if you're behind on your house payments, your home's in foreclosure, separate problem. The homestead will never protect you from the consequences of a foreclosure proceeding because the homestead doesn't stand in the way of a voluntary lien, such as a voluntary mortgage lien that you have taken.
And with that, let me turn to Sally in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi.
Hi, Sally.
Hi. I have a question, and I don't know if you've answered this. I haven't been listening to the show from the beginning. But I'm curious about the impact of the bankruptcy upon the possibility that the state of California may take over PG&E. And I was just curious what that might entail, and is there anything about the bankruptcy that would make that less likely or more likely?
I think it is completely unlikely. Think of it like this. For California to take over the company, California has to pay the value of the assets to the bankruptcy estate. Tin pot dictatorships that expropriate oil wells and other assets from the rightful owners, the state of California can't expropriate anything from PG&E. And if California wants the company, California has to pay into the bankruptcy estate the value of the PG&E assets. Mm-hmm. But there's a bigger reason why California would never do that. California doesn't want to step into the shoes of the utility that is likely to continue getting nailed for all kinds of damage claims. California's not going to want, as the state of California is not going to want to face all those liability claims from the next set of fires that come through. So I don't see California becoming an owner of the utility.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Sally, thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights. Would you say the same is true of a municipal entity picking up a small geographic area's operation from PG&E?
Well, I think that could be different. Your listeners in the Bay Area may or may not know that, for example, the city of Los Angeles owns its own water and electric power company, which is which is provided for under the Los Angeles City Charter, the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. Huge, huge organization, brings in hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue for the city. It's possible that maybe a water district or some local quasi-governmental utility entity might want to take over through purchase of certain PG&E assets. On the other hand, where electric lines are running through wilderness areas and so forth, they'd probably be crazy to want to take on those potential liabilities.
And with that, let me turn it over to Dave in Mountain View. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering, in the bankruptcy proceedings, are the executives of the corporation ever held responsible, and are they liable for any damages?
Yes.
It was they are the ones who actually made the decisions and gave the directions that ended up creating the disasters.
Well,
and so, you know, it's one thing for the corporation to have to pay, but, you know, like the chief executive of PG&E right after the fires quit and ended up walking away with like $2 million in for golden parachute. And, you know, can that
it's a good question. The directors and officers of the bankrupt company are not going to face personal liability unless they have committed crimes. Now, that happened in the Enron bankruptcy. It became very apparent quickly that there were crimes of fraud and other kinds of crimes that had taken place, and some of those Enron execs did go to prison. With respect to PG&E, any bad business decisions of directors and officers are going to be covered by insurance policies, errors and omissions policies that are purchased in order to protect members of the board of directors and corporate officers. So, really, shareholders, to answer Dave's question just a little bit deeper, shareholders would probably love to sue the officers and directors. To the extent there is any civil liability, you can expect it to wind up being covered by insurance. But then that implicates the insurance companies, who, if they're on the hook, are going to have to write checks for gazillions of dollars. So, you know, the whole thing could eventually wind up into, you know, like a chain of falling dominoes. The ramifications that could come out of something like this that are foreseeable or unforeseeable can be very massive and could spell legal and financial troubles for a whole lot of other industries.
You know, I hate to fuel, Dave, your frustration, but it's actually a step worse than what you said as far as the CEO leaving. She did not leave after the wildfires, or in short order after the wildfires. She left approximately 2 days before it was announced that PG&E was filing bankruptcy. So, for what it's worth, I don't know if that changes anything in terms of your perspective, Leon, but...
Well, I'm aware of that, and I sort of recall something just from the news media that she was hoping to get a huge golden parachute, many multiples of the couple million dollars that she picked up. And the powers that be of the power company said no. So it was kind of like a resignation or almost a termination for cause.
Dave, I hope that answered your question, and thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. We've been talking tonight about the PG&E bankruptcy and bankruptcy in general. My guest tonight is Leon Bayer, Certified Bankruptcy Law Specialist from the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar of California. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number here in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're calling from outside of San Francisco, please feel free to take advantage of our toll-free line. That's 866-798-8255. And again, that's 866-798-8255. As always, you don't have to call about the point we are in the discussion. You're not even limited to PG&E. The topic tonight is bankruptcy. You're welcome to call us regarding any question about bankruptcy, debtors' rights. I think, Leon, you'd be prepared to even answer about creditors' rights.
Yes, I do occasionally represent creditors in bankruptcy cases, not too often, but once in a while I'm called upon to do that. And that's interesting. You know, from a creditor who is wrapped up in a bankruptcy proceeding usually has their stomach tied in just as many knots as the average debtor who needs to file a personal bankruptcy. It's not a pleasant situation for individuals who file. It's not a pleasant situation for the creditors who are affected by the filing. And the creditors, as is usually the case in a consumer bankruptcy, take it on the chin and get no payment.
So again, with your calls tonight, that's 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And where we left off, we had just talked a bit about a liquidation model versus a reorganization model. And let's focus again back on the reorganization model, because that's really what, at least right now, PG&E is looking at doing. How much would a company in reorganization pay to its creditors? How do they figure that out?
They're going to look at the value of assets. PG&E has huge physical assets. It owns land. It owns equipment. But it also has the value of a going concern. It is a business. It's still in business. It's still providing utility services to customers and collecting the, you know, on the monthly bill for those services. So both the tangible and the intangible assets of the company need to be determined by valuation experts to make sure that any reorganization plan ultimately proposed is going to meet that best interest of creditors test by providing to creditors at least as much as the liquidation value of this company would have been. And, you know, while we're on the subject of reorganization, I haven't mentioned it previously in this show, but individual people are allowed to file a Chapter 11, but there is another type of bankruptcy that is very popular amongst individuals, which is Chapter 13 bankruptcy. It has certain similarities to Chapter 11, but it has nowhere near the complexity of a Chapter 11 case. And individual people may file a Chapter 13 case and reorganize themselves by using a Chapter 13 plan of reorganization to catch up back payments on a home or pay off income taxes over time, pay off other debts over time. Sometimes pay creditors much less than the full amount of what is owed on debts such as medical bills and credit cards. So there's a lot of advantage to Chapter 13 in the right situations. Chapter 13 can be an absolutely wonderful way for an individual to manage debts, for example, debts of the kind that might not be dischargeable in a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, such as the payment of arrears on spousal support and child support. As I mentioned, most kinds of taxes are not going to be discharged in a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, but you could manage them and pay them back in an orderly fashion, perhaps, under a Chapter 13 bankruptcy.
With that, let me turn it over to Rod in San Francisco. Rod, you're on Your Legal Rights. Welcome.
Thank you. San Francisco has the ownership of its delivery of electricity up to someplace near the city boundaries, and then has PG&E distributing the electricity within within San Francisco. Is there a possibility that in the past there's been the efforts which didn't pass the voters to buy out the PG&E services in San Francisco and have San Francisco take care of the entire distribution in the city? What is the possibility that in bankruptcy the city could somehow end up buying the distribution system here? Then as a separate question, it seems that PG&E accepted money to maintain these power lines and gas lines and so on, and chose to spend the money on something else. Does that make the directors and so on more responsible than just simple corporate fraud or corporate actions otherwise?
Well,
two questions.
It's a matter of opinion, and certainly on the company side, they're not going to agree with that statement.
Of course not. But you can go with the newspapers if you choose instead.
As far as the city of San Francisco purchasing assets, it's not like a rummage sale. Cities or other private people even who want to purchase assets don't just show up and say, I'm going to buy this or I'm going to buy that. It's going to be up to the debtor itself probably to propose the reorganization plan and explain what's going to happen to each asset. So it'll be a very detailed plan. San Francisco City may want to buy something, but unless the debtor is putting it up for sale, it's not going to happen.
What about the judge or the trustee of whoever takes over these properties, if that's the case?
Well, that is an interesting question. Normally, in a Chapter 11 case, the trustee is the debtor. We call it a debtor in possession because they have all the powers and duties of a duly appointed bankruptcy trustee when the case is filed, until or unless it is determined that they have abused their powers or not capable of carrying out their duties. I would be very surprised if a trustee, an outside independent trustee, is ever appointed in this case. They have representation by very experienced lawyers to represent the debtor in possession, and I think you can count on everything being done correctly.
Rod, I hope that answered your questions, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And with that, let me turn it to William in Belvedere. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm unclear about a couple of things. When there's a bankruptcy, somebody gets stuck. In this instance, a whole bunch of houses burned down. Most of them were covered by insurance, certainly if they had mortgages and everything, they were covered by insurance. But the insurance companies, they're going to go after PG&E. I mean, if PG&E was responsible. So
yes.
I'm unclear about who's
going to get... Insurance companies who pay out under a policy of liability insurance step into the shoes of the wrongdoer and have to pay the insured the, you know, value of what has been destroyed or ruined under the terms of the policy. But the terms of the policy then, as you say, William, allow the insurance company to then sue whoever seems to have been responsible for the loss in the first place.
Yeah, it seems to me that, as I say, I would like to be clear, and maybe it was said and I misunderstood, but who is really going to get stuck? I mean, even if the stockholders, if their all stock was eliminated, they got nothing, which isn't probably going to be the situation. But if it was a situation, the amount of damages, I understand it is, with the houses burning down, ultimately somebody, I think it seems to me like whoever buys electricity is going to at some point end up paying a whole lot more because of this thing the money is going to have to come from somewhere. Now, am I misunderstanding?
No, William, you don't misunderstand anything, and it's a very astute observation. In addition to the shareholders losing their ownership of the company,
right,
to the extent that there's shortfalls, it's going to be picked up by the ratepayers, because it'll have to be, because that's the only way to keep electricity flowing. So when you turn a light switch in your home, you get power. So one way or another, between the assets of the business and to the extent that there's any shortfall in assets to pay the rightful claims of creditors, it's the ratepayers, it's the customers that are going to pick up the tab by having their utility rates
increased. I had one other question connected to that. I hear about, you mentioned, the PG&E's got a lot of lawyers and they're going to do this and that and it's going to take a long time. Do you have a sense of how much money ends up going to the lawyers in something like this?
Sure. I would guess legal bills in this case are going to run into the hundreds of millions of dollars.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Thank you. Very disturbing, but very informative.
Well, thank you very much for the question.
William, thank you for joining us. How do I get in on that gravy train?
On that question from William, let me also point out that the fees that lawyers charge to their clients in a bankruptcy case, the fees for representing PG&E, are subject to approval by the bankruptcy court. The lawyers must have court approval for what they're charging, and creditor committees and other interested parties have the right to object to the attorney fee claims. So it's the lawyers don't have a blank check to enrich themselves. It's going to be another aspect of the PG&E case that probably will have a lot of litigation in just the narrow area of how much the professionals are going to be allowed to be paid.
And, of course, the court's not only going to look to the rates they charge, but also the work that they did and how much of it was necessary. Are they spinning their wheels to raise their to just generate fees, or are they really doing important stuff?
That's right. The bankruptcy court itself, as does the Office of the United States Bankruptcy Trustee, has tremendous expertise in these areas, and there probably will be questions asked, and there probably will be some contested matters requiring adjudication by the court, where creditor committees may object to certain fees that are being claimed by lawyers and so on. It's going to be, what did I call it at the beginning of the show? Oh, I think I said it's going to be a mess. Yeah, it's going to be a mess.
You mentioned about, you used the word objection a couple moments ago. Who can object to a reorganization plan, and how do they do it?
Creditors have the right to object if they are impaired. Impairment means that the creditor or the members of a particular class of creditors are impaired if the proposed plan takes away or limits legal rights that they used to enjoy. So, for example, let's say my washing machine that I bought at Sears has an extended warranty, and Sears proposes a reorganization plan that says they don't have to repair anything ever again from these extended warranty contracts, even though they've already been paid. Prior to the bankruptcy, people paid good money for these extended warranties. So if you are holding an extended warranty on your Sears washer, you could object to the plan. Probably the court would actually appoint, kind of in the nature of a class action, a group of lawyers to represent the interests of the particular class. So if such a proposal and a plan was being made that your warranty is no longer any good, your consumer warranty, there will be lawyers who have been appointed to represent that class of creditors and can litigate whether or not the plan can be approved to do that, to take away consumer rights or the rights of other classes of creditors. Bankruptcy, at the end of the day, is a really, it may seem as if the rules are very arcane, but I can tell you as a lawyer that's practiced in this field for almost 40 years, the rules, the procedures, the statutes in bankruptcy really have a ring of common sense to them. Once you drill down through all the legal language and stuff, it pretty much boils down to a set of rules that you or I would probably come up with if we had to develop an orderly system to deal with insolvencies. In fact, bankruptcy law itself is very similar to probate law. A lot of the rules are very similar, and a lot of things that you see in bankruptcy have been modeled on probate. Not to mention centuries and centuries of accumulated jurisprudence in the area of insolvency.
And happily, that correction from the days of the debtor's prison. This is Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden, where tonight we're talking about bankruptcy, and in particular the PG&E bankruptcy. My guest tonight is Leon Baer, Certified Bankruptcy Law Specialist, certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization, State Bar of California. You still have a few minutes to call us at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or if you have questions and you're outside of the San Francisco area, please feel free to call us on our toll-free number, 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on the topic, and that topic tonight is bankruptcy. You're not limited to the PG&E bankruptcy or where we may be in the conversation. Please feel free. You still have a few minutes left. And where we left off, you had mentioned the word objection. We had talked a little bit about who can object and how. Before we focus on the plan itself, which is really what I wanted to ask you about, I did get a question from a caller. Is Chapter 13 available to a homeowner who's fallen behind in his mortgage payments, or perhaps a student who's fallen behind in his or her student loan payments?
Yes. Particularly in the example of someone behind on mortgage payments, that is the classic example of a typical Chapter 13 case. Probably more Chapter 13s are filed to deal with mortgage arrearages and to stop a house foreclosure than for any other reason. The way a Chapter 13 helps such a person is if the foreclosure proceeding is ongoing, you're a homeowner, you're in foreclosure, you don't want to lose your home, the lender won't work with you. If you file a Chapter 13, it will stop the foreclosure sale from taking place. And it then gives you the opportunity to present your reorganization plan, which would probably provide for catching up those mortgage arrearages over maybe as long as 5 years if you need to. Mechanically, the way it's going to work is you must start making your normal regular payments again, so you don't get any further behind. And let's say you owe $30,000 in back payments. Well, that $30,000 in back payments, most people can't just write a check and pay $30,000 and catch up, even though legally that is what they may be required to do. Once they file the Chapter 13 bankruptcy, they can catch up that $30,000 by paying an extra $500 a month for 60 months. If they can afford to do that and afford to continue or resume paying normal, regular mortgage payments, then there's probably no reason why that person has to lose their home. So it works out very well in that kind of a situation. Student loans are more problematic. because the amount of money that people owe on student loans can often be as much as what people owe today on an average mortgage. You can use a Chapter 13 to catch up delinquent student loan payments, but then you're burdened with resuming the normal regular payment, which may be way more than what you can afford. I mean, I see people all the time that, you know, maybe their regular student loan payment is $1,200 a month, you know, but to somebody who earns $2,000 or $3,000 a month, it's impossible to pay. Chapter 13 can put the brakes on a student loan by keeping that loan tied up for as long as 5 years. Most student loans will not be discharged in a bankruptcy, and that means when you finish your Chapter 13 reorganization plan, the student loan will pass through at the end, and it'll be collectible again against you. What you're really doing in those kinds of situations is you're buying time. What's the use of doing that? Well, it may keep you from having your wages garnished and forcibly making you pay larger amounts that you are not able to afford. Maybe something will change. There are proposals that have been in Congress over recent years to make student loans dischargeable in a bankruptcy case. And the current administration in Washington has recently asked for proposals from the public as to how that would be accomplished. I responded to that by writing a letter to the committee that was looking into it for the administration, suggesting how they would do so, because in fact, student loans were dischargeable in bankruptcy in various, subject to some various requirements, but they were dischargeable in bankruptcy up until about 1998. Usually the requirement was you had to have made a good faith effort to pay, and that the loan had been in a repayable status for maybe 5 years, maybe 7 years prior to the filing of the bankruptcy. So until about 1998, student loans, many student loans were dischargeable, even government loans. The law was amended so that you couldn't do that anymore.
We have time for one last call. We don't have much time left, just a couple minutes, but I did want to turn it over to Art in San Francisco. You're on your legal rights.
Thank you. You mentioned the ratepayers would be picking up the tab on some of the costs in the bankruptcy of PG&E. Who represents the interests of the ratepayers in the bankruptcy proceeding, if at all?
Sure. It would be, I believe, the state of California through its agencies, including the California Attorney General, perhaps the California Public Utilities Commission. But one way or another, there will be many public voices that will be heard in the process. On the other hand, the paramount duty of the government and of the company is to continue providing utility services. And to the extent that there is a shortage of money to keep the power on, it's going to come out of the pocketbooks of the customers.
What about the profits made by PG&E? Would they be accessible instead, for example?
Well, yes, they would be, but there's not enough profit being generated by the company to pay all these claims.
Thank you.
Art, thank you for joining us in your legal rights. We have about a minute or so left before we close out, and I did want to ask you a couple of very, very quick questions, if I can.
Sure.
There was an article in Sunday's San Francisco Chronicle that speculates that PG&E may try to kill renewable energy contracts, that specifically solar and wind power. This begs the question, really, what's the object of the PG&E bankruptcy filing? What are they really trying to divest? I mean, we've heard talk of liability for fires, but now we're looking at these contracts. Do you have a sense of where they're going?
I have no sense, but I'm skeptical. And not really a conspiracy theorist, but PG&E is saddled with very burdensome contracts and obligations to purchase electricity from renewable energy sources. And they would like to get out of those contracts because they're not profitable and they're locked into paying rates for that energy, which are much higher than what it costs to purchase energy that's produced from fossil fuels. So to that extent, they may be looking to divest themselves of that. Another thing they probably are hoping to do is not to have to fight thousands of individual fire claims in court, but to have all these claims and the litigation that arises from each individual specific fire dealt with in more of a wholesale fashion. It can be extremely destructive to a business, like John Mansville with the asbestos claims, very destructive to an ongoing business to have to send lawyers into court on thousands and thousands of separate lawsuits that all concern the same legal issue.
With that, we're out of time. Do you want to take about half a minute to a minute and sum up? Any last-minute thoughts?
Well, I just want to thank you for having me on again. I'll point out, as I always do, bankruptcy. People shouldn't be afraid of bankruptcy. For the average consumer person in debt up to your eyeballs, bankruptcy is the best consumer remedy you're ever going to find. There, to imagine a law that will relieve you from the liability to pay all these financial promises you've made in the past but can't fulfill anymore, it's quite astounding that we have a fresh start law such as bankruptcy that really lets you start over.
And with that, Leon, let me respond. You've been very generous with your time and your help, both on the program and the Call a Lawyer program, and I would like to thank you. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight we've been talking about bankruptcy, and in particular the PG&E bankruptcy. Joining me tonight has been Leon Bayer of Los Angeles. Leon is certified as a bankruptcy law specialist by the California Board of Legal Specialization, State Bar of California. And as I said, Leon, you've been very generous with your time and your efforts. And on behalf of all our listeners, I want to thank you. And thank you for joining us tonight in Your Legal Rights.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back next week with Your Legal Rights. But instead of talking about next week's program, I'd like to take just a moment to discuss a special program coming up later this month on February 27th, which is also going to be a Call a Lawyer night. We're going to take a moment to reflect. It's been a year since Chuck Finney left us. It's been an extraordinary year. We've preserved his vision and kept it alive by keeping this program in operation. It's your chance to give us your feedback on the show. We're going to be asking you for your vision of the show's future, but that's 3 weeks out. Again, for tonight, you've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. For production assistant Martin McLean and at the controls, Joanne Marr, I'm Jeff Hayden. Our thanks to you for listening, and have a good night.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.